Radio with your host, Hal Shurtleff. This show is heard on WBCQ The Planet every Monday and Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can also listen to this show on Podomatic, podomatic.com, and put in Camp Constitution. And thanks to our listeners, we've been in the top one or top five for the last month or so, and even made the top one for our category of conservative broadcasting. You can also view it on our YouTube channel, usually within a week or so of this broadcast. We upload converted to YouTube video. And we are brought to you by Camp Constitution, which, among other things, runs a week-long family camp. And next year's camp will run from July 19th to the 24th in the Singing Hills Christian Camp and Conference Center in Plainfield, New Hampshire. And you can get more information, visit our website at campconstitution.net. Well, on the line is a friend that I had the pleasure of meeting on a few occasions down in Virginia, and that's Claire Lopez. How you doing, Claire?
Hi, Hal. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, just a few days away. And you're with the Center for Security Policy, and we're going to be talking about Islamic doctrine versus the U.S. Constitution. This is a book, The Dilemma for Muslim Public Officials, a book written by a colleague of yours, Stephen Kirby. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your organization.
Sure. Well, I am the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. Website there is centerforsecuritypolicy.org, or a shorter URL goes to the same place, and that's securefreedom.org. And the center is a nonprofit, nonpartisan 501c3, a nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C., focused on issues of national security, national defense. We are 31 years old this year, 2019, heading into our 32nd year. Founded and led by Frank Gaffney. Now, new president there is Fred Flights.
Is Frank still involved with the organization?
Yes. Frank has stepped back from the day-to-day kind of duties at the center, but he is our executive chairman still at the center.
Now, he wrote a book on not quite on this same issue, but on the Muslims. And isn't that book available as a free PDF? I saw it. I read it a number of years ago, and I was very happy to see it available.
Exactly.
I can't remember that. Yeah.
All of our books, and I am the author, co-author, and/or editor of all of our publications, which you can find and access at the center's website as free PDF downloads. All of them are free PDF downloads. If you'd like to read it that way, they're also published in paperback. Format and available on Amazon.com.
I am an old school type. I love the technology. I love PDFs, but I also prefer the little hard copy, the hard copy book, which it's hard to crawl into bed or sit by the fireplace with a laptop. It's not with a laptop.
Well,
you know, put it
you
down.
You know, you can highlight and tab them, and that's what
yeah.
I do with books too.
But it's great because there's so many books out there and other sources of information that are not known to people, and the PDF makes that quite makes it more available. So,
sure, it does.
So anyway, I had a friend a number of years ago of the Jewish persuasion, lives on Long Island, Bob Unger, and he read the Quran. He dedicated himself to reading the Quran. Now, he read it in English, and I understand to a Muslim, you know, you have to read it to the original version. But I think you can get a pretty good idea of what the Quran stands for. And he concluded, after he read this, he said, you can be a good person, but not a good Muslim. But you can't be, to uphold the Quran, you can't be a good person and a good Muslim. I mean, you can't be a good Muslim and a good person, is what he said, if you adhere to the tenets of the Quran. And now we have a number of Muslim office holders, which I'm not sure who the first one was in the country, but we have, what, five or six in Congress now. We have a number of legislators around the country, and some of them are converts. And each elected official, whether it's state even local officials, a state official has to take an oath to not only the U.S. Constitution, but also the state constitution. And that goes for city officials and county officials. And it's of my opinion, based on my understanding and, you know, reading books like this, that you cannot be a Muslim in good faith and take an oath to a non-Muslim document.
Well, you're getting at some of the key points that Dr. Steve Kirby made in this new publication that the center put out two weeks ago, I think, called Islamic Doctrine versus the U.S. Constitution, The Dilemma for Muslim Public Officials. And what he gets at in there is that because the doctrine of Islam obligates faithful, practicing, devout Muslims to prioritize faithfulness and allegiance to the legal system of Islam, which is Sharia, Islamic law. It's real law. It's really written. It is taught in the universities. It is preached in the mosques and Islamic centers. It's also adjudicated in Islamic tribunals and courts of law. It's real law. But all devout and practicing Muslims are obligated to prioritize Sharia above any other law, and that would, yes, include the U.S. Constitution. So this is the dilemma that Steve Kirby addresses in this new book. How can public officials in the United States who are Muslim honestly take an oath to the Constitution, which in so very many respects is antithetical to Islamic law? Now, we have currently three representatives, members of Congress. They are Representative Andre Carson out of Indiana, Representative Rashida Tlaib out of Michigan, and Representative Ilhan Omar out of Minnesota. Formerly, there was another, and that is Keith Ellison, who's now not in Congress anymore, but is the Attorney General for the state of Minnesota. So three
representatives there. I'd like to interject something here, if I could. When you look at the three sitting members of the House, the three Muslims, now, the average person who understands a little bit about the Muslim faith believes that Muslims are strongly family-oriented. They don't support the homosexual agenda at all. In fact, they're really hostile to the homosexual agenda. They tend to support free enterprise and those kinds of things. But if you look at the voting record of these three, and Ellison when he was in, they are hard leftists. So is it that that's not the case about Muslims? They tend to be socialists? What's happening here? Why are these Muslims embracing the homosexual agenda that in Muslim cultures are totally taboo?
That's a real dilemma. It really is. So, yes, the Muslim representatives that are currently serving in Congress are all of the Democratic persuasion, and so is Keith Ellison as Attorney General in Minnesota. And yes, that agenda of the Democratic Party, and by the way, the majority, well, maybe I shouldn't say majority, a good number, a large number of Democratic serving representatives in Congress are members of the Democratic Socialists of America, which is essentially the Communist Party of the United States. It is certainly Marxist. So how do they reconcile, the agenda, liberal, leftist, even communist and Marxist agenda of the Democratic Party when they run on that ticket? It's addressed in this book by Steve Kirby, and he gets at it in a couple of different ways. He points out that Muslims are permitted, I would say even obligated in certain circumstances, to lie to infidels. That is Islamic law.
And yeah, so you have a chapter on it. Islam, there's a chapter in the book, Islam allows Muslims to deceive non-Muslims. It's right in the Quran.
Absolutely. Not only just in the Quran, but one of the 99 names of Allah is the Great Deceiver. And that is not a pejorative. That's an attribute in Islamic doctrine.
To deceive the enemies of Islam.
And Muhammad himself is recorded in the hadith as saying, war is deceit.
Interesting. Yes, this book is very bad. Now, hasn't some of these Muslims actually swear on the Quran, not on the Bible? Because you wouldn't expect a Muslim to swear on a Bible.
I think there might be a bit of a misperception. When a new class of freshmen, members of Congress, comes in for the first time, they assemble on the floor of the House of Representatives, and it is there as a group that they take the oath to the Constitution, which basically says they swear affirm to defend and support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. What happens then is that many of them, well, some of them, may go to their own new chambers, their newly assigned offices, for photo ops. And there, in their offices, some may take and have done this and have taken for the photo op a picture of, you know, taking the oath with their hand on a Quran. Itself, of course, is a contradiction, oxymoron, visible oxymoron, I guess you might say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as a verbal one.
I think we should point out, too, that there are plenty of non-Muslims, people that call themselves Christians, that take the oath and they violate it and they have no intention to ever honor it. So I think we need to point that out, too. It's not just the Muslim politicians.
Yeah.
But at least to a Muslim, to a practicing Muslim. Now, I know there are a lot of Muslims that I guess in the Christian world, if you're a person who made a profession of faith but no longer adheres to it, you're considered a backslidden Christian. If you're a Mormon, they call you a Jack Mormon. And I actually know a gentleman, family that runs a pizza restaurant down the street. The wife had been an Orthodox Christian. She never, you know, stayed with it, and her husband was raised in Albania as a Muslim, but he doesn't practice the Muslim faith. So I don't consider him to be a Muslim in any stretch of the situation, they've become really Americanized and all that. So I'm not talking about those kinds of – they don't make any profession about being Muslim whatsoever. But it's these people who go to the mosques, and, it's interesting about mosques. I can go to pastor any church, and maybe even synagogue, and it would say, services on a certain day, all are welcome. And I can walk in there and sit down and listen to the proceedings. Not in a Muslim. You can't do that in a Muslim mosque, though, can you?
Well, actually, you can. And you would be warmly welcomed if you, as a non-Muslim, were to enter a mosque and, want to attend or observe the services. You would be welcome. Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
They would look at such a person as a potential, what they would call,
convert.
Revert, because, right. All of us are born
revert.
Muslim, and it's just our,
I see.
Our parents and our clergy
who
have distorted the lessons and the words of the scriptures so that we don't know that we were born Muslim, right? And so they call people who come to Islam, answer the dawah, the call to Islam, they call them reverts. So they would look at such a person coming into a mosque as a potential recruit, is essentially what we're talking about.
Now, there was a video floating around. I just saw a version. They said it was Tlaib talking about how we're gonna take over the country, and we're looking at all non-Muslims as future Muslims. It wasn't actually Tlaib. It was a lady who's since deceased. It was in the late 80s, and she's giving a presentation. And so my take on it is that when a Muslim comes to the United States, I'm not saying a devout, I'm not talking about like the guy who owns a pizza restaurant, but they come here not to immigrate, to swear allegiance to this country, and then what's the term they use when you immigrate, that you have to disconnect from all of your past allegiances. You can still love your nation of birth, but as far as any loyalties to your nation of birth, you have to reject that, and you can only be faithful to the United States. A Muslim in good standing, as a good Muslim, cannot do that. And do Muslims have a concept of nationhood as we do, or sovereignty as we do?
No, they do not. It's not the same concept. And let me just mention really quickly that I think you're making a really important distinction, Hal, when you talk about Muslims who are devout, faithful, and practicing, and those who are not. When we talk about Islam, we are talking about the doctrine, we're talking about the law, which is Islamic law or Sharia, we are talking about the scriptures. This is our frame of reference. People are human beings, and they're individuals, and they should be treated that way. The thing about someone in a free country like the United States, now I don't mean Taliban-controlled Afghanistan or Somalia or Pakistan or one of those places, but a free country like America, where you probably do not face the death penalty, which, by the way, is the legal penalty for apostasy from Islam. But most likely that is not going to happen to you here if you leave Islam. So the question then becomes, well, what are you hanging on to? Why are you still remaining a Muslim in a country that is a free country if you do not believe anymore in the doctrine, you do not adhere to the doctrine, the law, then why still Muslim? And the word Muslim itself, we might point out, means one who obeys Sharia. That's the literal definition in Arabic of the word. One who submits. To submit is to obey Sharia. So you have to ask, well, what is it that keeps you clinging to this identity if you really don't believe in it? Or what happens if your family, friends, imam prevail upon you tomorrow to return to a devout practice of the faith? And how would we know? You know, so these are just distinctions, you know, I think we need to keep in mind when we're talking about these issues.
I also want to, in your book, you have a quote from CAIR, C-A-I-R, the Center for American Islamic Relationships, which is not exactly friendly to people like us. But they even said that to criticize or take exception with Islam doesn't necessarily make you an Islamophobe. And that's the sad thing, is that people who have this knee-jerk reaction, you're just an Islamophobe or you're a racist. And first off, Islam is not a race. There are people from, there are blacks, whites, browns, yellows, they're just like in Christianity. Every single, if you don't like Christians, someone's going to call you a racist. That would be absurd, because it's not a race-based, it's religion. There's, unless you're a white Christian identity. So, but to be an Islamophobe, are you a Christophobe if you don't like Christians? And it's a dirty word. If you're an Islamophobe, I don't want to be called a phobe. So I better not say anything. Is that something that we see a lot in politics?
It's definitely a word that was created out of whole cloth by the Muslim Brotherhood, by the way, with the distinct purpose of stopping conversation, of smearing someone with an epithet that they don't want associated with their name. And it's intended to simply stop all conversation in its tracks. Whether about, you know, the latest attack by forces of Islamic Jihad or simply discussion of the doctrine of Islam itself.
Let me look at some of the, I'm just looking at the book here, some of the chapters we can talk. Understanding Islam, and you have understanding the Quran, and you discuss some of that. But the doctrine of abrogation, can you discuss that a little bit?
Sure. So the doctrine of abrogation, very simply put, means that in the Quran, very obviously, there are verses that do not comport with, do not agree with other verses. But if we look at the Quran as a chronological account, the book itself is not put together chronologically. It is put together literally from the largest surah or chapter, the longest one, to the shortest one. Except for the first surah, which is the Fatiha. But that makes no sense if one is simply reading the book from cover to cover. But if you take the various surahs and arrange them in chronological order as it is told to us that the verses were revealed, as Muslims believe, to Muhammad, and put them in that order, then you get a set of verses, a set of surahs or chapters that Muslims believe were revealed to Muhammad when he was still in Mecca, the place where he is from, they say. And then you get a set of later, chronologically later surahs that were, as they believe, revealed, quote-unquote, to Muhammad after the hijrah in the year 622 when he, Muhammad, is said to have migrated from Mecca to Medina with the few dozen followers that he'd amassed at that point. So because the verses don't all agree, and you can put them in this chronological order, abrogation simply means that what comes later, the verses that come later, abrogate or supersede the verses that come earlier, chronologically speaking. That's all it means. And this is a way of getting around somehow attributing a mistake to Allah.
So it's an escape clause. It's sort of an escape clause. If in an early surah he said, you know, like you have Quran 3:28 where it says, don't befriend the infidels. But then, then you're supposed to love everybody. It's a religion of love in the later surahs.
Well, I don't know of any place in the Quran where it actually says it's a religion of love.
Religion of love, right?
But you're onto the right, the right interpretation of things here. But the basis for abrogation actually comes from a number of verses in the Quran itself, and I'll point to just one of those, which is verse 2:106, and there it says, none of our revelations do we abrogate it. By the way, this is in the voice of Allah. If it's in the Quran, Allah said it. So none of our revelations do we abrogate or cause to be forgotten, but we substitute something better or similar. Okay? So this is verse 2:106. And this is the basis, among a couple of other verses, there are a few more along those same lines, that basically say what comes later abrogates that which comes earlier if there is a mismatch, contradiction. And this applies, this is very important, because as we talked about in the chronological sequence of these chapters, these surahs and verses, those that Muslims believe were revealed to Muhammad in Mecca, the earlier period when they were few in number, powerless, ridiculed, and rejected, those verses tend to be the least hostile to others, the least violent of all. But then, after the hijrah, again, 622, when Muhammad and his followers are said to have migrated to Medina, then called Yathrib, from that point onwards, we looking, you know, again, chronologically at the verses in the Quran, those verses become far more aggressive, hostile, and outright violent, to the point where you get to the very end, the ultimate or penultimate, perhaps, surah of the entire Quran, is the ninth surah, the surah of the sword, it is called. And there we have the most aggressive, hostile, violent verses of all against infidels, that is, non-believers in Islam.
Now, this book that you folks put out, Islamic Doctrine versus the U.S. Constitution, you have chapters amendment by amendment, and we don't have the time to get into all of them. But how does the First Amendment, which guarantees or protects, I should say, the freedom of worship, the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, and freedom of religion, how is that, and not to establish a church or a particular state religion or federal religion, how does that match up to Islam?
Well, this would be chapter four in Dr. Kirby's book. It's called Islam and the First Amendment. And for one thing, we know that there are five liberties guaranteed to Americans in the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. And these are freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and the right to petition the government for redress of wrongs. Not a single one of those appears any place in Islamic law. Let's take freedom of religion. Now, it says in the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that Congress shall make no law, et cetera, establishing a religion. Well, in Muslim-controlled countries, and we glossed over this, maybe I did, a little bit ago about the concept of nationhood. You know, the Western world is arranged since 1648, according to the Treaty of Westphalia that put an end to decades of horrific warfare in Europe, Western Europe, by nation states. And essentially what the Treaty of Westphalia says is nation states are sovereign, and what goes on inside those borders is the prerogative of those people of that nation and their government, unless it spills over and threatens others around them. But the concept of Islam is global. It is without borders. It is an Islamic nation, the ideal, what they are striving for, and it is called the Ummah, U-M-M-A-H, it's sometimes spelled, and Ummah means the global community of all Muslims. This is what they look to. So never mind the government shall, you know, the Congress shall establish no law. The law for all Muslims, wherever they may be in the world, is and always will be Islamic law, Sharia. And so it matters.
Claire,
not.
We're running out of time. So,
sorry.
30 minutes goes by awfully quick when you're especially when you have a good guest like you. Give the listeners where they may be able to get a copy of this book and also where they can get a hold of you and your organization.
Sure. So the PDF free download copy of this and all our publications, including occasional papers, may be found at centerforsecuritypolicy.org or securefreedom.org. Many of my own articles are published there. You can also get hard copy paperback books from our publications at Amazon.com. You can follow me on Twitter in my name, Claire M. Lopez, also at Facebook in my own name as well. I also blog at Newsmax, Newsmax.com, on a regular basis, and my articles appear there and then also at the center's website.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being a guest. And, folks, you've been listening to Camp Constitution Radio. Happy New Year, and until next week, may God bless you.